Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the age of the super PAC mean for political engagement and civil discourse in America? While federal election law forbids campaign donations from any individual to any one candidate over $2,500, independent expenditure-only committees, better known as super PACs, can accept unlimited amounts of money from individuals and corporations and spend it to promote whatever candidate they like. The result is a dramatic increase in election spending by uber-wealthy donors, whose ability to pay for all-important advertising effectively gives them the power to decide who can mount a viable campaign. Journalist Thomas Frank explores all this in his cover story for the April issue of Harper's Magazine. The piece is called It's a Rich Man's World, How Billionaire Backers Pick America's Candidates. Tom, welcome back to Think.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you. You know, it seems like every election cycle brings new talk of record spending. But since Citizens United, the increases have been unprecedented.
Yes, that's right. There's the place to look is in the midterm elections in 2010, which were after Citizens United, and compare them to the last midterm elections in 2006, which were before Citizens United, and there's this enormous increase. I believe it's a five-fold increase. I mean, it went up by multiple of five times in what they call independent expenditures.
You start this article with an examination of how media outlets have rather obsessively covered campaign advertising in recent months, not so much for its content, but for the amount of revenue it creates for those same organizations.
Yeah, we cover it as a kind of spectator sport. And by the way, the examples of this just pile up and pile. I just saw one this morning. You know, basically the news media hasn't really figured out how to deal with this, what to say about it, and so they sort of fit it into their traditional horse race. They talk about advertising in the traditional way that they talk about politics, which is this kind of horse race thing. So, you know, who's ahead in the polls, who's behind in the polls. So apply that to advertising, and it's like, you know, who's raising more money, what are they spending it on. So you're looking at these efforts to basically manipulate people, and the only question you're allowing yourself to ask, or pretty much the only question, is, you know, is it working? Are they manipulating us? Are they pulling the wool over our eyes? The other question that they ask, and they do this all the time, I discovered after, you know, reading a lot of this stuff, is they talk about the fundraising and spending on advertising as a form of redistribution, you know, from the billionaire class to, you know, who funds these campaigns, from the billionaire class to the TV stations in your town.
You know, it's funny because there's been talk of that here in Texas. We have a very, very late primary, and therefore we miss out.
So you're not going to get any of the largesse. That's funny. I mean, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm really sorry to hear that. But it's ironic. And then there are places like New Hampshire, which get this really disproportionate amount of it, or Iowa, you know, where that's basically what that state is all about anymore.
Yeah, and where is it? Is it in New Hampshire where there's a TV station that was essentially bought by Steve Forbes?
Well, not bought, but he spent so much money. This is another very amusing campaign trail story, in this case by David Frum. And he said that Steve Forbes spent so much money on ads in 96. When did he run? It was 96 and then again in 2000. And he spent so much money on ads in New Hampshire that that one of these TV stations was able to build a really lavish office for itself, and they call it the house that Forbes built.
So let's talk specifically, Tom, about why Citizens United allowed for so much more money to be poured into campaign media. First of all, what does the law say about the amounts of money that people can give to specific candidates?
I believe that is still that's still restricted. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure now. I'm not. It's been a while since I did all the research on this. I'm pretty sure that the amount that you can give directly to a candidate or a campaign is still really limited. Mm-hmm. But the amount you can give to an independent, you know, expenditure committee, which is what a super PAC is, is that's unlimited. You can give as much as you want. And by the way, journalism watchdogs who are forever correcting journalists for getting things wrong love to point out that it's not just Citizens United. There was a second court case called Speech Now that that specifically made the Super PAC possible. But that's the result of Citizens United, and they decided that basically the money that you spend on politics is a form of speech, and as such, it can't be restricted, because of the First Amendment to the Constitution.
And when these court cases were first being decided, there was debate over whether it would really make that much of a difference, whether people were really just chomping at the bit to give more money. It turns out, super wealthy donors must have been just dying for all these decades because they have just flooded campaigns, or rather, super PACs with money.
I think so, yeah. I mean, a long time ago, I mean, politics really was, I'm talking about the late 19th century here, politics really was a sort of sport of millionaires. There's these incredible stories from back then about, you'd have U.S. senators who would say, it's the senator from New York Central or the senator from a given company. And often people would get their personal lawyers sent to Congress as U.S. senators and this kind of thing. That happened all the time in the late 19th century. That was the sort of golden age of political corruption. And it kind of died down for lots of different reasons. But today, you see, not only do you see the billionaires really coming back into the process in an enormous way, but also, being really sort of self-righteous about it and also, frankly, really candid about it and about what they expect from it. They talk about it in the language of investing or even in the language of gambling. I put such and such money behind him and, my bet came in or something like that. And also they think this is right and proper, and that their voices should be heard more. That their voices should be louder than other people's voices because they are obviously the most successful people in the community.
It's almost as if, I mean, certainly they want the candidates that they want to win, but it's almost like some of this advertising comes back to convincing the American people that the interests of the super wealthy are the most important.
It does that in a kind of de facto way. Yes, that's exactly true. But our politics have been heading in that direction for a long time. And I wrote a book that just came out a couple months ago called "Pity the Billionaire," which is about the sort of direction that all of this stuff is going in. Where we talk about job creators, which is a kind of euphemism du jour for wealthy people, job creators, and how we have to be really nice to them and don't make them angry and don't call them names, because if you call them names, they'll pack up their money and go away and they won't hire people and John Boehner actually said that a couple months ago said that the economic slump that's been going on for years now was actually what was causing it was a strike by job creators of America. The job creators have basically gone on strike because they're sick of regulation. They're sick of they want this sort of entire bill of legislative things done immediately. And if they don't get that, then they're not going to create any jobs.
It's such an interesting line of debate right now, Tom, because my understanding is that there is research to show that sort of regardless of the benefits that they have to pay, and I've seen this relating to the new healthcare laws, employers are going to hire people when there is enough business to hire more people. They're not going to hold back.
Course. Right. This is just a fantasy. What Speaker Boehner was doing was just trying to think of a way to cast his sort of political issues as something that we all need, not just something that one class of people needs. This is a classic. This is what politics is about in some way, to cast your own desires as the desires of everyone or the needs of everyone.
I mean, are we being too cynical here? Is it not possible that some of these very wealthy donors truly believe that that the candidates they support are best for the entire American people?
They might. I'm sure they believe that. There's no doubt about it. Absolutely. I think that's there's no question about that. But they tend to talk about it in terms of you know, making an investment, you know, having that investment pay off, that kind of thing. I'm sure they you know, they believe what they believe, and they certainly don't think that they're going to hurt America. I mean, that wouldn't make any sense to spend all that money to. You know, certainly they think they're doing the right thing.
Thomas Frank is here. We're talking about his cover story for the April Harper's Magazine, It's a Rich Man's World, How Billionaire Backers Pick America's Candidates. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Thomas on the line in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, it really bothers me that this term job creators and that we have to keep their taxes low when, in fact, job creation is tax deductible. And so against a higher tax rate, they would presumably be more encouraged, if they don't like paying taxes, to avoid taxes by investing, hiring, do research and development, expanding their businesses, capital investment. Any capital you buy gets depreciated. That is a more rewarding process, the higher your tax rate. But we've sort of fetishized these low taxes, and I don't know if there's much academic support for it.
What do you know about that, Tom?
Well, the caller's absolutely right. I mean, there's already, I mean, it's a pretty favorable time to be rich in America. It's a really good time for that. So if you're out there thinking about being rich, this is your moment, man. I mean, what can I say? These economic arguments, you can always reframe it and say, well, taxes are low, but they are obviously aren't low enough.
Mm-hmm.
this is a country that singularly adores billionaires, but you still have those filthy hippies out there in that park in New York City saying mean things about billionaires, and so they've got to stop doing that. You know, there's always room to go either way with these things.
I suppose it makes sense in a country where people don't play the lottery when the prize is $10 million, but they will sort of trouble themselves to play the lottery if the prize is $650 million.
I even thought about it. And I'm pretty cynical.
All right, so let's go back to super PACs here. Officially, they are supposed to be independent of the campaigns that they support, meaning that the communication is restricted between them. Can you talk a little bit about how campaigns and the PACs that support them are able to collaborate or not collaborate?
Well, we don't really know the answer to that. I mean, there's a lot of theories about that, but it certainly is not very hard. You know, if you are in the if you're running the Mitt Romney super PAC or the super PAC that was set up by, you know, Mitt Romney's people, you're not allowed to coordinate with the Mitt Romney campaign. But it's really easy to see what the Mitt Romney campaign is up to by turning on the television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we know who he's going to be running against, right? It's going to be Barack Obama. It's really not hard to figure these things out. The fascinating thing, though, is that this idea of deniability, that, you know, the Mitt Romney super PAC is not really Mitt Romney. And so Mitt Romney can come across as this very friendly man who would never hurt a fly, and his super PAC can do these incredibly vicious things, although also very amusing things, you know, the TV commercials that they ran that really ruined Newt Gingrich's campaign back in Iowa, and then they did it again to him in Florida, and that really finished him off.
My guest is journalist Thomas Frank. He wrote the cover story for the April issue of Harper's Magazine. The piece is called It's a Rich Man's World, How Billionaire Backers Pick America's Candidates. Welcome back to the conversation in a moment. We've got lots of you on the line already and one line open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Thomas Frank, a journalist who wrote the cover story for the April issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called It's a Rich Man's World, How Billionaire Backers Pick America's Candidates. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tom, we're only now really fully entering the two-man contest for the presidency itself. How evenly matched are Republicans and Democrats in terms of contributions to super PACs?
I don't know about that because it's a it's such a new phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I, the sort of conventional wisdom would say, well, Republicans must do better because they're traditionally the party of business. And Democrats are traditionally identified with with labor and minority groups and outsiders and that kind of thing. But Barack Obama obviously last time around in 2008 outraised his Republican rival and raised this tremendous amount of money. I think it was the first campaign ever to raise $1 billion. So a lot of that came from Wall Street, and they aren't backing him this time around. Mm-hmm. They're going with the Republicans this time around, or so it seems. I mean, we're still really early in the cycle.
Yeah,
hard to believe.
Doesn't feel early.
All the ads in the elections that we've already had, but we're just getting warmed up.
Well, it always strikes me that when we have these conversations about campaign ads and how they're funded and whether or not they're appropriate, we're talking about all the power that you have in these. Especially radio and television ads. And we almost, for these conversations, set aside the many discussions we have, all the hand-wringing about the decline in the power of traditional media, both
yes,
print and broadcast.
That's a really good point. And it we also talk about it in a really strange way. And we talk about it as spectators, right? As though you and I and, the people on the Internet who comment on these things and the various, newspaper columnists observe this going on and all these things being done to other people. Like, look at how these ads are manipulating, these people. They're sitting there watching these things on their television set, and absorbing these ads. And the ads tend to be, pretty lowbrow. And we look at it almost this kind of class divide between the commentator class and then the class of people who just absorb, or that's how we look at them. I mean, it's a really crude form of advertising criticism, but that's what you see out there.
Well, we have an email here from Elizabeth who says, why can't journalists respond with an equal stream of facts? Wouldn't constant fact checks help level the playing field?
And they do this. This is a distinct trend in journalism now. You have, all these different newspapers and organizations that try to fact check people's advertisements. And I guess it's supposed to function as a kind of, a check or a balance on this sort of thing. But I think that I don't think that's, obviously I don't think that's enough. Political speech can't really be regulated. So even if a commercial was wrong, I mean, nothing's going to stop the candidate from running it. He can do whatever he wants, know. And it's also, it's a form of sort of advertising criticism that really doesn't, and by the way, all of our talking about super PACs blends over into advertising criticism because that's obviously how super PACs do their business. It's all through advertising, mainly TV advertising. And I'll just take a step back here. In an earlier life, I used to write about advertising. That was when I was getting a PhD, and I wrote a book about the advertising industry. And so it's a subject that I'm very familiar with. And I think that To hope that if journalists just look at the facts and point out when things are wrong, that will fix the situation is a little bit naive.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, journalists really do think that. They think that it's all going to be okay if they can point out, the mistakes made in these TV commercials. But that's not it. The fact that you need to run $1 billion worth of TV commercials in order to become president changes the situation. It changes the process. And you could say, well, the process has been changed in that direction for a long time ago. And that is certainly true. But the higher the price tag gets, and this year it's going to be enormous, the higher the price tag gets, the more politicians are naturally driven, and our entire politics of this country are driven in a way that we probably would not choose if we had a say about it.
It is also a sort of insidiously brilliant strategy for the people who want to decide who becomes president or senator or congressperson, in that these ads and the great preponderance of them shifts the analysis that the media do. We don't have time to do anything except, you know, fact check. I mean, you know, I'm exaggerating here.
But we talk about the ads.
Right,
exactly. We do this kind of really naive ad criticism. And the story that you talked about, like, oh, well, where's Texas's share of the, you know, of the largesse?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what got me started on this whole story was an article I saw in the Kansas City Star, and talking about the state of Missouri becoming a Republican state, a red state, you know, to use the term that, you know, that we all use now. Whereas in the past, Missouri, well, a long time ago, used to be a very Democratic state. This was, you know, Harry Truman's home state, that kind of thing, and then became a battleground state in the last few presidential elections. Has been a battleground state. It could go either way. But now apparently polls show that it's more reliably Republican. And that's a very interesting change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a, you know, a historian and a sort of student of politics, I love talking about things like that. It's, you know, that sort of cultural shift, fascinating. But how did the Star choose to go about describing this in terms of the money that the state would lose out on? You know, if it's a state that Republicans can count on winning and Democrats don't think they can win, they're not going to spend money on TV commercials in the state. You know, and this is what got me. I was like, that is a really peculiar way to describe this kind of cultural shift, you know, in terms of the ad revenue that you're going to lose. But then, you know, I started looking around. That's how everybody is talking about it now. That's just how we cover this change. It's the only way that journalists feel they can do it without offending people.
Do you happen to know if campaign contributions are tax deductible?
No, I honestly don't know that. It's one of the reasons I don't know is because I don't make any myself.
Nor do I. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Dennis in Dallas. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I wanted to jump back to the discussion portion where we were talking about money at risk. And I'm a small businessman, and I've started a number of businesses over the years. And I think what gets lost in this conversation is that when you start a business, you are, to some degree, betting your money. And usually when you're starting a business, you're also creating jobs. And if the balance of the risk and reward is not right, you're not going to do it. And I think that's what we're at risk at right now, of getting that balance wrong, where people are going to sit on the sidelines because they're going to say the risk is high and the reward is getting smaller. And so that the logic of that, if you're in that boat and you like to start businesses and you like to create things, is you're going to go support candidates that are going to try to keep the balance acceptable.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Tom?
I think that sounds very reasonable, but it's also really subjective. And, you know, that's not what I do for a living, and I wouldn't really know what that balance is. But I think that sounds, you know, pretty reasonable.
What do we know about what super PAC mega donors expect in return from the candidates who benefit from their contributions? I mean, theoretically,
we don't know much.
Yeah,
these guys tend to be pretty smart and keep their mouths shut.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because obviously you don't want to describe it as a bribe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would look real bad. You don't want to talk about quid pro quo. There's lots of very interesting statements that have been made, though. I'm thinking of a Chicago billionaire. He's like a hedge fund billionaire, and he said that he thinks that that bankers don't have enough of a voice, aren't listened to enough in American politics, and so that's why he was giving money. You have Sheldon Adelson, who generally doesn't do a lot of interviews, and he was, you remember, was the big backer of Newt Gingrich's campaign.
Sure, he's the guy from Las Vegas, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And he said something really interesting. I believe it was in Forbes magazine. It was in an interview. He said he's against wealthy people influencing elections, but as long as it's doable, I'm going to do it.
Hmm.
And then he referenced George Soros, who's another, you know, very wealthy guy that's traditionally given to Democratic campaigns. And he says, what are his words? I know that guys like Soros have been doing it for years, if not decades. So it's kind of an arms race for him. You've got, you know, he wants to keep up with, he wants to make sure that Soros is balanced dollar for dollar or something like that. You know, interesting way of looking at it. So it's, you know, it's becoming this sort of sport of billionaires.
Well, and there is a certain perverse logic to it. I mean, if everybody else
Absolutely.
Is doing it on
if
the other side.
If the other guys are doing it, you better do it, you know, just like any other form of market endeavor. Now, this actually raises a really, I brought up the M word there, the big M, the market, and this brings up a really interesting point in its own right. And, you know, a lot of us and a lot of the people listening to this program probably think, you know, it's almost second nature to think money in politics is a bad thing. For, I mean, all the reasons that we're describing here, it distorts our politics. It, you know, all these ugly TV commercials. You have things like the Abramoff scandal. You have those 19th century, you know, politics basically becomes a matter of more or less a form of bribery. You know, all that sort of stuff. It's ugly. It's awful. We're all against it. But there are people in America, they don't say this out loud very often, they don't write articles saying this, but there are a lot of people who think that we should have more money in politics, not less. And the reason is because they want politics to act like a marketplace. They want it to be, a market, like any other market. They want it to, you know, politicians to respond to supply and demand. You know, very interesting way of looking at things. And those people are really happy with Citizens United and getting more money into politics and seeing it become this thing where the billionaires are bidding against the other billionaires.
I mean, at the end of the day, though, Tom, what all these ads are endeavoring to do is to convince regular middle-class people like you and me who will go to the polls to cast a ballot for a particular candidate. I mean, at some point, doesn't this still boil down to one person, one vote in this country?
Of course. Yeah, it's always, at the end of the day, it's up to you and me, individual voters, you know. These billionaires can give as much money as they want, but they can only vote once.
Or we are led to believe.
But what we don't understand is that the decision is largely made already, the decision of who the candidates are, you know, who can get out there and appeal to the billionaires, you know, who can win their money over. And it's fair to say, in this story, by the way, I go back to one of my favorite presidential races, the contest in 1896 between William Jennings Bryan and William McKinley. And Bryan was regarded, you know, he was this sort of amazing orator who won the Democratic nomination. Nobody expected him to. A lot of people never even heard of him before, but he wowed the crowd at the Democratic convention with a famous speech, and they nominated him. And he was against the gold standard, and he was very pro-farmer, pro-labor. These were all, you know, unusual things in politics at the time, so unusual that people regarded him as a kind of anarchist. And they were really a lot of sort of business interests regarded him as a kind of anarchist and really threatening, really dangerous. And they poured money into the campaign of William McKinley, who, I mean, outspent him. There's lots of books on this subject, but one of the books that I consulted, what was it? I'm looking at it here. Outspent him between 20 to 30 to 1, and still just barely beat him, you know, using every sort of technique known to the late 19th century political mind, still just barely beat him. And I often wonder if that's the kind of politics that we're becoming again, you know, with these people just pouring money in these insane quantities and basically making a figure like Bryan impossible, you know, because now you don't nominate a candidate by acclamation at a convention because he gave a good speech. It's this long, long, long process, as we've just seen. You know, it goes on for months and months and months, and only the person who's able to raise money from the billionaire class is going to succeed. We now know that. And that limits our choices. So, yeah, you and I have the final say, of course, and maybe you and I are so smart, as you know, like the Supreme Court justice has said, when they handed down Citizens United, consumers are so smart that they aren't fooled by ads. Maybe that's true, but the fact is that the choices have already been, you know, winnowed down to two people, both of whom are going to be billionaire friendly. They have to be in order to play this game. So the choice has already been made for us.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Mark on the line next in Arlington. Hey, Mark.
Hi. Mr. Frank mentioned earlier that he does absolutely believe these billionaire super donors he's talking about believe they're doing what's right for the country. And my question is, what's the possibility that actually what they're doing is what is right for themselves and using the political leverage they purchase to enrich themselves, whether or not they necessarily believe that that's good or right for the country as a whole?
Oh, of course that's true. Both of these things are true. This is, people often confuse their own interests with the best interests of the country. That's a totally, utterly normal. And you know, I think that's what the caller said is completely correct.
Well, and it's human nature, and it happens on all sides of the, you know, everywhere on the political spectrum.
That's right. Except for that, by the way, I'm totally objective, and what I want is actually right for the country.
Yeah, you somehow have figured this all out.
Yeah, you saw that one coming.
Back to the phones now. Let's speak this time with Todd in Dallas. Hey, Todd.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks so much for the opportunity to visit on this topic. I think the topic is very interesting, and I would agree that a lot of things in the political process are not working well. Two things. One, real quickly, Barack Obama and oddly enough, Ron Paul have both raised a lot of money from small donors using the internet very successfully. So I think that is a point that should be made. Secondly, which is contrary to the billionaire class argument to some extent, although offset by the amounts of money that are derived from billionaire class people as you describe them. Secondly, political contributions are not tax deductible. But thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, I think that it would seem to me that what we really need is engagement of people more than anything else. And at the grassroots level and all the way through the rank and file, the reason that there are decisions made for people is because people are not engaged the way they should be. It's stunning to see the amount of apathy that's out there, notwithstanding all the media attention to the presidential elections and other elections. And I think with all due respect, to some extent, that's evidenced by the fact that each of you didn't know the answer to the question, are political contributions tax deductible? I mean, that's a very fundamental question. And for people involved, it just shows how, A, it's more expensive than you would think, and B, two people who write on the topic aren't aware, and therefore it would suggest you're not as involved as we would hope.
Interesting points, Todd. I really appreciate it. We need to take a quick break. We will be back in a minute with Thomas Frank. He wrote the cover story for the April issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called It's a Rich Man's World. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here this hour with Thomas Frank, who wrote the cover story for the April issue of Harper's. It's a Rich Man's World, the piece is called, How Billionaire Bankers Pick America's Candidates. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. And to follow up on what Todd said before the break, Tom, including what I think was probably a fair slap on the wrist to both of us for not knowing the answer to the question of campaign contribution deductibility, I wanted to come back to his point of saying... He pointed out that the Ron Paul campaign and the Barack Obama campaign have raised a great deal of money through small internet contributions from individuals.
Right.
I guess the point that you are going to here is that, you know, if 9,000 people gave Ron Paul $100 each, they're unlikely to get the same kind of attention for their individual key issues that one person who gave him $900,000 might get with a single phone call.
Well, that's right. And but the small donor, the internet, that really was the sort of great campaign theme of 2008. And it was, we are living in highly ironic times where, the history seems to be moving in two directions at once. So on the one hand, you have the empowering of the individual, usually, it's always said via the internet, because anybody can start a blog now. Or, they don't need to read the newspaper. They can, make it up themselves or something like that. And, everybody has heard this, so many times. It's very familiar. And it's interesting to me that while that theme is going on and it's definitely happening, that you that everything is also moving in this other direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's more power for the you know, for the big companies and the rich individuals, and you know, that's the other great theme of our time, is sort of the coming together of essentially economic oligopoly. And you know, it's ironic that both of these trends exist at once, but now we see it in politics. And my feeling about it is that the sort of hopeful trend distracts from what is of the a trend that is actually going to be more influential, more meaningful, which is the power of the billionaire class. I don't really think Ron Paul has a chance. And we'll see with Barack Obama whether the small donors make the difference or it's, you know, the big Wall Street types. I mean, we'll see this fall. But my feeling is that the narrative about small voices, individuals, it's comforting to believe that, but that in reality things are going in a different direction.
Of course, there is the reality that at least for now, Barack Obama has the colossal advantage of holding the office of President of the United States, as,
that's right.
as does any incumbent.
That's a big advantage, and that should – that's ordinarily that would mean he would raise more money than the other side.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. What I'd like to know is how exactly did the Supreme Court Citizens United decision change the rules for these super PACs in accepting donations? Like, what were the rules pre and post decision?
Well, there weren't super PACs, thanks for your call, before Citizens United and the other decision. Is that right, Tom?
Right. And I think that the, I mean, there were independent expenditure committees, but they weren't huge, you know, and if you go back and look at them from before 2010, there weren't a lot of them. They didn't spend a lot of money, and I believe donations to them were restricted also, just like donations to an actual campaign.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Ben in Dallas. Hello, Ben.
Yes, Mr. Frank, thank you for I look forward to reading your article in Harper.
Awesome.
I just wanted to 2 points. I wanted to bring up, I heard on the radio, another radio station the other day, that the corporate taxes in America are the highest in the world and that Japan is second. You're saying this is the best time to be a big, rich corporate guy. This is your time right now, and I was wondering your opinions on that. The second thing was, I'm a small businessman and, you know, not a millionaire, but made over $150,000 last year, and this economy was tough, but did it. And lo and behold, I found out that once you go over $150,000, you lose your deductions. You don't get to claim them. And so I ended up paying a lot of taxes. So
is this personal tax?
Yeah, well, I'm a sole proprietor. I'm not a corporate.
Yeah.
And
it's funny, I filed the same way.
and so you know, I hear these numbers of 250,000. You know, we should tax more, or you know, all these numbers. But the magic number is 150,000. I found out the hard way. And this year, I plan to do a corporation. So, you know, that risk of putting money out to hire people and do a business will be more balanced.
Yeah. Well, generally speaking, this is a common problem. Because, you know, you hear people like me say that taxes are low in America, and then and by the way, about the corporate numbers, generally, you know, when they say the U.S. has the highest corporate income tax in the world, they're not counting all of the sort of loopholes, deductions that, I mean, the big corporate, all these news stories of the last couple of years about the biggest corporations essentially paying nothing, you know. And so what happens is that the taxes and the burden of filling out the paperwork tends to lie much more heavily on small business than it does on big business. This is, and same with regulation, same with just about anything. It's very easy, or not very easy, but easier for big business to comply with all that stuff, and much harder and more labor intensive for people like you and me. And that's just the nature of the system. I'm sure, you know, obviously it should be more equal, but that's the way things are today.
You know, it's been interesting, Tom. I read about this recently, and I don't believe it was in your article, that the super PACs, there was a lot of talk about corporations making these contributions, but in fact, right. 80% of the biggest contributions are coming from individuals.
That's right, yes. Although I saw just the other day that a banking trade association has come together to put all kinds of money into this, and so I think you'll start seeing more of that. But by and large, yeah, it's very interesting that it's so far just been very wealthy individuals, you know, hedge fund guys that own run hedge funds. By the way, it's also really fun if you're a journalist or if you're, you know, kind of nerd like me, to go down the list of, say, Mitt Romney's donors and try to figure out who they all are, you know, because they're all very public people. And it's really interesting. Like, he's got a whole bunch of Walmart heirs, you know, donated to his campaign, all these different hedge fund people. Fascinating.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we have Gabriel in Plano. Hey, Gabriel.
Hi, Chris. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Chris, in my personal opinion, I think all this money has been polluting Washington very badly. It's the worst thing that has happened to the democracy in the United States. I think we are going for a monocracy. And that's very bad because the people that have the money, they try to take care of their interests. For example, I'm an engineer, and to be more productive, if I have to move a plant to China, I will do it. I don't care if there's no jobs in here. Over there, there's more production, less price, more competitiveness. So the capital doesn't have a heart. Doesn't have nationality. We have to be very cautious about it because we're giving up a lot for less. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for your call. You know, Tom, to Gabriel's point that money, in his opinion, is polluting Washington, is there any way to take...
Well, that's certainly true.
But is there any way to take the money out, realistically? Let's get down to brass tacks.
This is one of the things that we tend to be fatalists about these things and say, well, it was always that way, but it wasn't always that way. You know, but the problem here is that there's really very little you can do if the Supreme Court is bent on bringing money into the process and making it function like a market. there's not a lot you can do. But of course, there are ways to keep the money out of the process. By the way, my last book, the one before Pity the Billionaire, it was called The Wrecking Crew, and it begins with the sort of question. You know, I moved to Washington D.C. about 8 years ago. And was surprised to learn that it was the richest city in America, you know, the richest metro area. Anyways, you know, all these suburban counties, very wealthy. And I wanted to know why that was. And the standard explanation is, well, because all those government bureaucrats. But you look into it, and government bureaucrats aren't paid these sort of outrageous. You know, they're we know what they're paid because it's all public knowledge. And that wasn't the answer. And the answer, it turned out, was all of these companies. Government contractors have relocated to Washington. You know, we're busy privatizing government, or we have been for years, decades, privatizing the operations of government, putting it in the hands of these private companies that are all located here in D.C. And then the other answer is lobbying, which is this enormous business here and, you know, enormously lucrative business. These people are paid all kinds of money. And that's, by the way, an essential part of turning politics into a market is lobbying. And are there ways to – yeah, I mean, there's lots of ways to change this. Stop outsourcing government. Stop privatizing it. There's lots of ways you can crack down on lobbying, but we don't, you know, we don't do them. Even President Obama, who talked so big about, you know, keeping lobbyists out of his administration, that hasn't happened. You know, he immediately reversed himself on that. And there's, you know, the Democratic lobbyists basically – picked up where the Republican lobbyists left off a couple years ago.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Sandra on the line in Southlake. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, and I always love your program.
Thank you.
I just want to know what will happen if, as a protest from the citizen of how bad has become the political system, we do not choose any of the presidential candidates in the ballot?
If we don't vote?
We will go to vote, but in a protest, we do not choose any of them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what's happening. You know, these are the choices are being made. I mean, they're being made by other powers, not by us. You know, at the end, as we were saying earlier, we get to choose, and we'll get to choose between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. It now appears, and that's our choice. And if you say, well, that's not a very satisfying choice, Mr. Frank, I would agree with you. That's kind of a lousy choice, and it's going to get lousier as the years pass. You've touched on one of the really depressing things about a two-party system. And what I often think we should do, you know, what would really make American politics interesting and fun and probably yield results that were closer to what people actually wanted is if the two-party system was not enshrined in law. Here, this is one of my sort of little pet subjects that I know something about. Do you want to hear it?
Sure.
So I mentioned William Jennings Bryan earlier, and when he was running for president, there was a third party in America called the Populist Party. And they were a sort of left-wing party, small business, organized labor, and farmers. Okay, and they were big in Texas, huge, as a matter of fact. They even started in Texas. I'm from Kansas. They were so big in Kansas, they elected two governors, a handful of senators and representatives, took over the state legislature a couple of times, that sort of thing. It was a third-party movement from top to bottom, from like mayors of small towns to a presidential candidate. We're not talking about an individual billionaire running for president here like Ross Perot or something like that. We're talking about a real a political party, a third party that challenged the other two.
So what happened?
Well, when populism died down after 1896, basically every state where it had been strong passed laws making certain the strategies that the populists used, or I should say the tactics that the populists used, against the law. Not because, you know, they used a tactic called fusion. It's a long story what this was, but this is what they did. And it's against the law now. And there's no reason for that. It's just that the two parties got together and said, we don't want this to ever happen again. It would be really, really neat if we overturned those laws and had, the state of New York is one of the few states that doesn't have those laws. And so you have essentially four parties there. You have the two main parties. You have a conservative party, and you have something called the Working Families Party, which is a left-wing party. And you would see that all over the country. And you'd have basically – every point on the political spectrum would have their candidate, and you'd have a much more articulate political debate. I would love to see that happen.
There would certainly be a lot more opportunities for analysis.
Yes, they keep people like you and me in business forever, right?
Journalist Thomas Frank wrote the cover story for the April issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called It's a Rich Man's World, How Billionaire Bankers Pick America's Candidates. Tom, it's always interesting to have you on. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, anytime. I'm happy to do it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find out more about that podcast and download a free copy of it at kera.org/Thank. You can also check out upcoming programs there. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.